Good morning. We're going to pick up where we left off. So let's do a quick review. We had just taken a pause from the historical record in the intertestamental period to talk about two of the things that were going on throughout the period, the challenge of Hellenization and what was happening with the Jewish high priesthood during this period. And so we kind of went through the Hellenization that was happening, that had been happening over a number of years during this period, and the challenges that that presented to religious worship in Jerusalem. And then we, right at the end there of the last time we were together, we talked about the overthrow of the line of Zadok in the priesthood. So we had Onias III was the final priest from the line of Zadok, and he was replaced with the Hellenizers, Jason, and then later Menelaus. And so we talked about that last time. And then a few weeks ago, prior to that, we talked about the Antiochian persecution. So you remember the passages we read from Maccabees about the persecution that was happening in Jerusalem, the setting up of an idol in the temple. So all of those things kind of came to a point at a particular place in time, and that's kind of where we are today. And so we're going to pick up there with a new handout number 9. Hopefully everyone has it. And we're going to be looking at what's called the Hasmonean dynasty, and beginning with the Maccabean revolt. So our sources for this period are primarily 1 Maccabees, a little bit of 2 Maccabees, and then Josephus' Antiquities and his war also, the Wars of the Jews. He's relying on 1 Maccabees as well as some other sources like Nicholas of Damascus and the historian Strabo. Then I've used some secondary sources which are in the bibliography, which I won't refer to at this point in time. We'll be reading some from Maccabees today. Okay, and I also handed out a sort of a family tree of the Hasmonean dynasty, which we'll be referring to in a little while, so you can kind of keep that handy. Okay, so precursors of revolution that led to the Maccabean revolt. We'd already covered in detail the severe persecution that happened in Jerusalem under the reign of the Seleucid ruler Antiochus IV Epiphanes. And we read the story. You remember the story about how he was rebuffed by the Romans in Egypt and vented his fury on the city of Jerusalem, slaughtered many Jews, desecrated the temple and set up an idol, most likely an image of Zeus in the temple, and compelled the Jews to basically repudiate all of their Jewish traditions. You recall the stories we read of the mothers who had their children circumcised were hanged, and scriptures were confiscated and burned. It was not a pleasant time to be a Jew in the city of Jerusalem or in Judea at the time. So, as you can imagine, a severe persecution like that really polarizes the population. Up till that point, remember, the Jews had been on fairly good terms with the rulers. First, the Ptolemy rulers from Egypt, and then more recently, even the Seleucid rulers from Syria, Antiochus III, had a pretty good relationship with the Jewish people. And so this sort of change of policy by the Seleucid rulers really began to polarize the Jews so that a very strong resistance movement began to develop naturally when you undergo something like that. Now, the resistance movement wasn't new. There had always been a resistance to the Hellenization that we talked about a couple weeks ago. You remember the different categories of responses that we looked at for Hellenization. Some people accepted it, but a lot of Jews did not accept it and resisted it. So there was a resistant movement to Hellenization that had always existed, and it really functioned in a group of people that became known as the Hasidians, or sometimes the Hasidim. Hasidim is a Hebrew word that refers to pious ones. So they would be the conservative, religiously minded folks who wanted to retain the traditions of the Jews. Incidentally, Hasidim You may hear in that Hasidic Judaism is a branch of Judaism today. These are not the same thing. So Hasidim back then is not the same as Hasidic Judaism today, which is a mystical branch of Orthodox Judaism today. So just in case you were confused by those terms. Hasidim here means the pious people. And this is probably the first time that they're mentioned by name in 1 Maccabees. This is the first time that we become aware of this group that actually has a name attached to it. But basically what these folks were the pious religious segment of the population who resisted Hellenism and called others to continued obedience to the law. In other words, standing in obedience to the law, even when it meant persecution in the face of the Seleucid rulers who, you know, pretty much outlawed Judaism at this point in time. And so that brings us to the spark, the catalyst of the revolt that actually started. So you remember this persecution started in the desecration of the temple happened in 167 BC. And about a year later, in 166 BC, there was in the village of Modin, which is a little village 17 miles northwest of Jerusalem, if you can picture that on your map, the Greek commissioner came to the town to compel the people in the village. And I presume that this was sort of happening as people would, you know, they had a lot of influence in the big cities like Jerusalem. But there were also commissioners from the Seleucids going out to the villages as well to make sure that everyone was living by the rules that had been laid down. And so I think what we have here is a specific example of that, where the Greek commissioner came to the village and basically compelled the people there to offer pagan sacrifices. And this is part of the agenda to eradicate Judaism, not only in Jerusalem, but in Judea and in Palestine in general. So the story goes that when he refused, they compelled, specifically the spotlight went on to an elderly priest by the name of Mattathias, who was viewed as a leader in the village. And they asked him personally to offer the sacrifice, and he refused, and another Jew stepped forward to offer the sacrifice in place of him. And so, and rather than tell you the story, I think I'm just going to read the story from 1 Maccabees, and you can hear it for yourself. Remember, 1 Maccabees is a historical account of what happened during this period, really starting at this point and then going for the first few Maccabean rulers. I'm going to read chapter 2 of 1 Maccabees, and I'll read up to verse 28. You can just listen to the story. Now, it was in those days, you remember we read in from 1 Maccabees a few weeks ago, that the last verse of chapter 1 is that Israel laid under a reign of terror. That was after the Antiochian persecution. So and then the next verse picks up in chapter 2. It was in those days that a certain Mattathias, son of John, son of Simeon, came on the scene. He was a priest of the Joiarib family from Jerusalem, now settled at Modin, and he had five sons, John called Gaddis, Simon called Thasus, Judas called Maccabeus, Eleazar called Averon, and Jonathan called Apphus. When Mattathias saw the sacrilegious acts committed in Judea, and above all in Jerusalem, he said, this is a poetic portion here, "Oh, why was I born to see this, the ruin of my people, the ruin of the holy city, to sit by while she was surrendered, the holy place given up to foreigners? Her temple is like a man robbed of honor. Its glorious vessels are carried off as spoil. Her infants are slain in her streets, her young men by the sword of the foe. Is there any nation that has not usurped her sovereignty, any people that has not taken plunder from her? She has been stripped of all her adornment. She is no longer free. She is a slave. We see the temple, which is our splendor and glory, laid waste and desecrated by the Gentiles. Why should we go on living?" Mattathias and his sons tore their garments, put on sackcloth, and mourned loud and long. The king's officers who were enforcing apostasy came to the town of Modin to see that sacrifice was offered. Many Israelites went over to them, but Mattathias and all his sons stood apart. The officers addressed Mattathias. "You are a leader here, a man of mark and influence in this town, with your sons and brothers at your back. Now you be the first to come forward. Carry out the king's decree as all the nations have done, as well as the leading men in Judea and the people left in Jerusalem. Then you and your sons will be enrolled among the king's friends. You will all receive high honors, rich rewards of silver and gold, and many further benefits." In a ringing voice, Mattathias replied, "Though every nation within the king's dominions obeys and forsakes its ancestral worship, though all have chosen to submit to his commands, yet I and my sons and my brothers will follow the covenant made with our forefathers. Heaven forbid we should ever abandon the law and its statutes. We will not obey the king's command, nor will we deviate one step from our way of worship." As he finished speaking, a Jew came forward in full view of all to offer sacrifice on the pagan altar at Modin in obedience to the royal decree. The sight aroused the zeal of Mattathias, and shaking with passion and in a fury of righteous anger, he rushed forward and cut him down on the very altar. At the same time, he killed the officer sent by the king to enforce sacrifice and demolished the pagan altar. So Mattathias showed his fervent zeal for the law, as Phinehas had done when he killed Zimri, son of Salu. He shouted for the whole town to hear, "Follow me, all who are zealous for the law and stand by the covenant." Then he and his sons took to the hills, leaving behind in town all they possessed. So that's the beginning of the Maccabean revolt. Hear it firsthand there from 1 Maccabees. So Mattathias and his family had most likely been from the priestly family in Jerusalem and had fled from Jerusalem when the persecution was happening in order to go to this village of Modin. And then you can understand what happened here from what I just read. So you could see from this account that he had five sons, John, Simon, Judas, Eleazar, and Jonathan. And after this event, you can imagine that they probably expected a pretty strong and quick response to what they had done. They had killed one of the king's officers, and so they took to the hills, basically. Now, what happened after this is the growing of the resistance movement. So many Jews also fled to the hills along with them and joined Mattathias and his sons. And then there's an account here early on, it's actually the very following section here, which I'll also read, of something that happened on the Sabbath. So one of the things that the enemies of the Jews quickly realized is that they kept the Sabbath. So guess what? That's a very good time to take a military action, much like what happened in 1973 at the beginning of the Yom Kippur War, when Israel was attacked by several forces on the holiest day in the Jewish calendar. So the same thing was happening here. We also see the same thing happening in some of the sieges of Jerusalem later under the Roman period. The Romans quickly realized that the Jews wouldn't really fight much on the Sabbath, so they took advantage of that. But in any case, at the beginning of this, there's a decision that had to be made. And I'll read you about this decision right here that Mattathias and his sons made early on in the revolt. "At that time, many who sought to maintain their religion and law went down to live in the desert, taking their children and their wives and their livestock with them, for their miseries were more than they could bear. Word soon reached the king's officers and the forces stationed in Jerusalem, the city of David, that Israelites who had defied the king's order had gone down into hiding places in the desert. A large body of soldiers, setting off in pursuit, came upon them and drew up in battle order, ready to attack on the Sabbath. 'There is still time,' they shouted. 'Come out. Do as the king commands, and your lives will be spared.' 'We will not come out,' was the reply. 'We will not obey the king's command to profane the Sabbath.' Without more ado, the attack was launched, but the Israelites did nothing in reply. They neither hurled stones nor barricaded their caves. Let us all meet death with a clear conscience, they said. We call heaven and earth to witness it is contrary to all justice that you are making away with us. So on the Sabbath they were attacked and massacred, men, women, and children, up to 1,000 in all, along with their livestock. Now when Mattathias and his friends learnt of it, their grief was very great, and they said to one another, If we all do as our brothers have done, and refuse to fight the Gentiles in defense of our lives as well as our laws and customs, then they will soon wipe us off the face of the earth. That day the decision was taken that if anyone came to fight against them on the Sabbath, they would fight back, rather than all perish as their brothers in the caves had done. So this was an important decision that was made early on in the revolt by Mattathias and his followers and his family, that it was their right to defend themselves on the Sabbath. And we'll see that carried out through the later revolt period and down into the Roman period, that basic premise that they wouldn't go out on the offensive on the Sabbath, but they did defend themselves on the Sabbath if they were attacked. Now, one key factor in the growth of the movement, the resistance movement, was the support of the folks that we mentioned earlier, the Hasidim. So there's a lot of debate about whether the Hasidim were actively involved in the military part of the revolt. It was well known that they were religious resistors to the compromising that was being required, but there is some debate about how involved they got in the actual revolt. They did rally behind Mattathias and his family, and in the early stages, they definitely provided military support. They brought numbers, they brought moral support, and they were, you know, recognized by the population as the keepers of the traditions of the law and whatnot. So that was an important factor in having more people feel comfortable joining the revolt movement. This is one of the first times, if not the first time, that they're referred to by name here in 1 Maccabees. In 1 Maccabees here, the Hasidim are referred to as the folks who come and help join the movement, and how important that is to bolster the resistance movement. Okay, so what happened is, after this, Mattathias and his sons became more and more organized, and they began to actually win some military victories as the band grew. They defeated the Seleucid forces in a series of skirmishes, and really what we would want to think of here is sort of guerrilla warfare, where they were always very careful to fight on terms that were favorable to them because they knew they couldn't stand up against the real army of the Seleucids. But they were in the Judean hills, and if you've been there or if you've seen pictures of the Judean hills, it's a pretty barren, hard to access area unless you're very familiar with it. And of course, that's one of the places that David hid out often when Saul was pursuing him. And basically, that's the same general area that Mattathias and his sons were hidden out, as along with all of the people that were following them. So they had some skirmishes and some guerrilla warfare victories over the Seleucids, and the movement became a growing and more organized resistance as more and more Jews joined them. You can imagine if after they had some successes that more and more people would join them and support the movement. So what happened in the family here is that Mattathias, the one who had really begun the revolt by taking a stand, died very soon after the revolt had started, actually. This is still in 166 BC. And so his son, Judas, took over the leadership of the revolt. And Judas, as you heard from the passage we read here, is Judas Maccabeus. And so when you hear the Maccabees, it's from Judas Maccabeus. So technically that term only applies to Judas. It's typically used to apply to him and his brothers. And then following that, it's usually referred to as the Hasmonean dynasty, which I'll explain in a moment. So after Mattathias died in 166 BC, his son Judas picked up the mantle of leadership. And it turned out that he was a very able military leader. The name Maccabeus means hammer. And most likely that's because he was a strong military leader. It's Judas the Hammerer is another way to think about it. So that's what Maccabee means, if you've ever wondered about that. It means the hammer. And he began to win many victories. First, again, in more guerrilla skirmishes against the lesser foes, you know, and sort of sneak attacks and things like that. But really growing into full military victories over some of the Seleucid generals. Again, as I mentioned, they would often arrange the battle. So their tactics were to not get into trouble, to be mobile, to take advantage of their knowledge of the terrain and the hills and the hiding places. There are many stories about them marching through the night and doing a surprise attack at dawn. You know, they were completely unexpected to be in the area. A lot of clever tactics like that that you can get away with when you have a smaller mobile fighting force that isn't as tied down to all of your supply lines and all of the infrastructure that you have to move an army, which was more likely what the Seleucids were, the model that the Seleucids were using at the time. So they began to win a lot of victories. Now, the Hasmonean name, the origin of the dynasty name Hasmonean is a little bit unclear. Two things have been suggested as the root of that. One is that there was a grandfather of Mattathias by the name of Asmoneus, who's referred to by Josephus. It's possible that the family name is taken after his grandfather, Asmoneus. The term Hasmonaim also in Hebrew means princes. So it could be related to that these are princes that were following in the line of their father. It's not exactly clear. Either one of those is a possibility. But when we talk about Hasmonean, we're talking about the family of Mattathias and typically following the first generation. The first generation is typically still referred to as the Maccabees. So I'm going to skip over all of the battles and everything and just, you know, there's a lot of history there. Basically, in about a 3-year period, they won more and more victories, became more and more powerful, and began to push the Seleucids back. And you can imagine the Seleucids were very disconcerted at this point in time, trying to squash the rebels, you know. And remember, their headquarters are in Antioch in Syria. And so it's a little bit of an outpost over there. And they were constantly sending different people in to try to solve the problem, you know, to squash the rebels. With varying degrees of success, sometimes they were able to contain the movement and win some victories, but then Judas and the family of the Maccabees would get the upper hand again. At any rate, it was a lot of battling back and forth over about a 3-year period. And then that brings us to December 164 BC, at which time Judas was able to get control of the Temple Mount and actually cleanse the temple. Now, you might remember from Daniel that this is predicted, and I'll read you a passage that we read earlier from Daniel chapter 8. I don't remember if I pointed this out before. Just to remind you where we are, this is the vision of the ram and the goat. So it's the coming of Alexander the Great, if you remember, and then the horns that grew out of the head of the goat. So we've got the first horn, which represented Alexander, which was broken off in the midst of its power, if you remember, replaced by 4 smaller horns. Those 4 smaller horns would correspond to the 4 generals, the visions of Alexander's empire. And if you remember, one of the horns started small but grew in power to the south, in the east, and toward the beautiful land. This was the one that put an end to the daily sacrifice. I'm just paraphrasing Daniel here. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. That's most likely referring to Antiochus IV Epiphanes, the perpetrator of the persecution. But anyways, in verse 13 of chapter 8, it says this, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to him, 'How long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, and the surrender of the sanctuary and of the host that will be trampled underfoot.' And he said to me, 'It will take 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated.' Well, it just so happens, if you do the math, the 2,300 evenings and mornings, if you divide that by two, because there's two a day, it's 1,150. And that's the three-year period that happened here, depending on when you start the dating. You know, it's as usual with these, it's a little tricky. But from the time the temple was desecrated and the abomination of desolation, which is most likely a statue of Zeus, was set up in the temple, till the time that we come to here, December 164 BC, where the temple is cleansed and rededicated. So that's an interesting prophecy from Daniel that once again is very accurately fulfilled, as you might expect. So what happened is Judas retook Jerusalem, and he was able to force the Seleucid soldiers into the Acra, which, if you remember, there was a citadel near the Temple Mount that we've talked about before. And it was basically a stronghold, a big tower fortress where the Seleucid rulers would hold up whenever they came under attack. It was kind of impregnable. It stayed that way for decades. And he was able to force them into that citadel and reclaim the Temple Mount. So the temple rituals were able to be restored. They cleansed the temple, you know, took out the statue of Zeus. The abomination of desolation had been in the temple for 3 years, from December 167 to December 164. And they were able to get rid of that. So you probably already know that this is the celebration of the rededication of the temple is still a Jewish holiday today. It's called Hanukkah. And, you know, like on our town green, they still actually allow a manger scene, but they also have a Hanukkah there, which is the Jewish nine-candle candlestick that is associated with Hanukkah, which is called the Feast of Lights. That's the commemoration of this event. And I can read you in here in Maccabees where that comes about in chapter 4, 56. This is after the dedication. They celebrated the dedication of the altar for 8 days. There was rejoicing as they brought whole offerings and sacrificed shared offerings and thank offerings. They decorated the front of the temple with gold garlands and ornamental shields. They renovated the gates and restored the priest's room, fitting them with doors. At the lifting of the disgrace brought on them by the Gentiles, there was very great rejoicing among the people. Judas, his brothers, and the whole congregation of Israel decreed that at the same season each year, the dedication of the altar should be observed with joy and gladness for 8 days, beginning on the 25th of Kislev, which translates into early to mid-December on our calendar. And so out of that comes the tradition of Hanukkah. The Hanukkah, which is what I refer to, is really the nine-stemmed menorah, if you're familiar with a Jewish menorah, the seven-candle stick, which is related to the candlesticks in the temple. The Hanukkah is a variation of that that has nine candlesticks that represent the eight legendary days that the temple lamps burned, with one in the center, so the 8 days on the side. So there's a further legend that isn't actually in Maccabees, or I don't believe it's in Josephus either, but there's a further legend that, and you may have heard the story, that they ran out of oil during the dedication, but the lights miraculously burned for the whole 8 days without going out. So that's just another legend that has grown up around this. But the Hanukkah, the 8 days that this celebration and rededication happened. Now, Jews, of course, still celebrate Hanukkah today, and this commemoration was celebrated in Jesus' day. You probably are aware that it is mentioned in the New Testament. It's called the Feast of Dedication in John chapter 10. So, you know, it's something here that happened 164 BC, and then we have it referred to in the time of Jesus that it was actually a commemoration that was going on, just like we read here from Maccabees. So that brings us up to the recapture and the rededication of the temple. I'll go through some of the subsequent events here, but maybe it's a good time to pause for questions or comments. Yes, Jen. The question is, how does the abomination of desolation here relate to the passage in Matthew 24 when Jesus refers to the abomination of desolation? That's a very interesting topic that is interpreted lots of different ways. There's a lot of different ways that that's viewed. So first of all, he's referring back to Daniel. That all comes from Daniel, the abomination of desolation. So in my view, so I can give you my view of this, there's lots of different takes on this if you read some of the literature, the commentaries, or even books on more like end time type things that'll deal with this passage. So my view is that this is one of those things that has multiple fulfillments. It's referred to by Daniel, the abomination of desolation, and that had certainly a partial fulfillment in the setting up of the idol of Zeus in the temple, which is what we just read about being cleared away. So that, I think, is a pretty clear reference to that happening. However, we learn from Jesus refers to it as still having a future fulfillment as well. So this is one of those things that there might be multiple instances where it is a partial fulfillment. So the next event that happened that Jesus may have been referring to here, that's pretty much my view, is that Jesus was referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 here when another Roman general entered the temple. And when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the temple, flee to the hills. So that could be a reference to what happened in the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And there's a lot of people that believe that most, if not all, of Matthew 24 was fulfilled in that destruction of Jerusalem. And then there's another view that there's a future piece of this as well. And my personal view is that it's a mixture of things that were fulfilled in AD 70 in a future reference here. One thing that you have to remember is when Jesus is saying, when you see the standing in the holy place, the abomination that causes desolation. So one of the things that you notice there is that there has to be a holy place for this to happen. And so what would that look like in an end fulfillment? It was pretty obvious in Jesus' time. The temple was still standing. The temple was destroyed. And so that's one of the things that leads me to lean towards a fulfillment of that in AD 70. So it's just, you know, food for thought. And like I said, you can get some very scholarly commentary on the different views of this in some of the commentaries. Yeah, well, there's two sides to that, right? There's a passage also in Paul's letters to the Thessalonians that is indicating that if you are being faithful and you're reading the Word of God and you're basically, in our language, if you're attending to the means of grace and living a faithful Christian life, you are prepared. And it isn't going to surprise you when the Lord comes again. So that's an assurance we have. You know, we kind of get caught up in the move of our culture that, you know, the thief in the night thing, and people are going to disappear and be frightened. And it frightens Christians, too, which is not the biblical message here. Just one other thing to point out, that sort of the two mixtures of things that possibly were historically fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem. And then, like Pastor said, there's a future trouble coming. If you just keep reading there, which, you know, you were reading that passage, but when you get down later like at verse 30, you start to see, at that time the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky and all the nations of the earth will mourn. You will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Again, referring back to Daniel. So you've got this interesting appropriation of what Daniel was saying in Jesus' authoritative word, but that's clearly referring more to the second coming. And so you can see there's often a mixture, and it's called telescoping in the theological term, you know, that it sometimes these things, when you look down through time, it has different expanding fulfillments. And this is one of those passages that's probably in that category. What we'll do next time is we'll go into what happened after this, where the revolt ended up, and then we'll briefly go through the org chart here, the Hasmonean dynasty, which you can see if you look way down at the bottom, kind of brings us right down to Herod the Great. So then we'll pick up a little bit on the Roman happenings at this point in time.